We're gonna take a trip right now. Like we always do about this time.
This is a journey into sound. Break it
down. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. On the first half of this week's show, I'll be speaking with the rock and roll legend, Graham Nash. He'll be performing at the Palladium on Sunday, April 23rd. And during the second half of the program, I'll talk with the Pulitzer Prize-nominated composer, Augusta Reed Thomas. She'll be premiering a new work titled Toward a Secret Sky with the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir on Friday, April 28th at the Hilbert Circle Theater. But first, I want to remind you that we're in the middle of WFYI's Spring Pledge Drive. WFYI is always here for you, keeping you plugged in to local music and community happenings. But we're only able to do that with your financial support. Go to WFYI.org/give and start giving today or increase your monthly membership. Even just a dollar more a month can make a difference. Thank you. It's been 60 years since Graham Nash cut his first records with the Hollies. The Hollies enjoyed considerable success in America, scoring multiple hits during the British invasion era of the mid-1960s, including Carrie Ann on a Carousel and Bus Stop. Bus stop, bus go, she stays, love grows under my umbrella. All that summer we enjoyed it, wind and rain and shine. That umbrella we employed it, by August she was mine. Nash left the Hollies in 1968, joining forces with David Crosby and Stephen Stills to form the influential trio Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Nash composed some of the group's biggest songs, including Our House, Teach Your Children, and Marrakesh Express. Traveling the train to glimmer rock and skies. Ducks and pigs and chickens call. Animal carpet wall to wall. American ladies 5 foot tall and blue. Nash's work with CSN often reflected the whimsical pop music he created with the Hollies. But his songwriting took a more serious turn when Nash launched his solo career in 1971. Nash became known for addressing political and social issues in his music. One day a friend took me aside, said I have to leave you for buying something from a friend. They say I've done wrong for protecting the name of a man. They say you'll have to leave you. So now I'm bidding you farewell for much too long. Graham Nash will join me in a moment to discuss all of this and more. But first, let's listen to his politically charged debut solo single. From 1971, this is Graham Nash with Chicago. That was Graham Nash with Chicago, and Graham Nash is my guest this week. Let's join our conversation. Thank you so much for taking time to speak with us today, Graham. It's an honor to have you on the program.
Thank you, Kyle.
Yeah, and you'll be performing here in central Indiana on April 23rd at the Palladium. This tour is billed as 60 years of songs and stories. And I understand this year marks the 60th anniversary of your emergence into the world of popular music. Tell us about the significance of this anniversary.
Well, when you get to my age, you know, I've never really been a man that looked back. You know, there's nothing you can do about any of the records that we've made. There's nothing you can do, you know. One of the interesting things about looking back is just how fascinating my life has been to me. I mean, I'm still amazed at my life. You know, even 81, I still feel young. I still feel healthy. I still feel passionate about what I do. I'm still grateful to be a musician. But I do realize that, you know, to a certain degree, I'm coming to the end of this life, and I'm looking back on it a little. And it has been a fascinating life, I must tell you.
I agree. You also have a new album coming out this year titled Now, and I want to spend some time talking to you about the record. I have an advanced copy, and it's really an amazing record that I know your fans will, me included, will love. One of my favorite tracks on the album is Buddy's Back, which is a tribute to the great rock and roll legend Buddy Holly. Tell us about this track and the significance of Buddy Holly on your life.
The Hollies obviously had a deep love and respect for Buddy Holly. He wasn't like Elvis, you know. He didn't slick his hair back. He didn't shake his ass, you know. I mean, he wore glasses, you know, and a straight suit. I mean, he was one of us, you know. And we loved the simplicity of his music. And to this day, I still feel this connection with Buddy Holly. For instance, when the Hollies did Peggy Sue Got Married, to Buddy's acoustic version that he recorded, the very apartment where he recorded those last things in his life and where he walked out of the door and got in a cab and went to the went to the bus and started his fatal last tour. But that apartment is for sale. So what an incredible circle it would be if I, you know, unfortunately, it only has one bedroom and I need a little more room than that. But isn't that a funny circle?
That is. His music has been such an influence on you that you still track little details of his life like that.
Indeed.
I'm gonna tell you how it's gonna be. Are you gonna give your love to me?
You know, I don't think people in America really recognize how influential he was on a global scale. I mean, obviously the Beatles, I think their name is sort of in tribute to the Crickets in a way. He really transformed the British rock and roll scene.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
And that was the very first time I ever saw Johnny and the Moondogs, which ended up being the Beatles. This was November the 19th in 1959. Mm. And they did, in fact, in this show that we did, sing Think It Over by Buddy Holly.
Think it over what you just said. Think it over in your pretty little head. Are you sure that I'm not the one? Is your love real or only fun? You think it over, yes, think it over.
And Graham, one of my favorite aspects of your work is your advocacy for human rights, freedom, social justice, environmental justice. You know, I really appreciate the way you've used your music as a vehicle to speak up on these issues. And on this record now, there are several very powerful songs in that vein. Stand Up, Golden Idol, Stars and Stripes. Can you tell me about that aspect of your work, why it's important for you to use your art to speak on behalf of these social and political issues?
I think it's the duty of every artist, no matter what genre, painting, drawing, sculpting, music. I think it's the duty of every artist to reflect the times in which we live. And part of that recognition, I'm always looking, you know, for items of news that really interest me, you know. I have to feel something before I write about it. And that's the way it's been all my life. And I seem to vacillate between being deeply in love, like I am with my wife, Amy, and being completely pissed off with what Trump is doing to the truth.
Yeah. What, if you want to elaborate on that, what in particular has kind of provoked you in this present social political atmosphere to pick up the guitar, to pick up the pen and express yourself? Anything in particular you'd want to comment on?
I feel a need to speak my mind about stuff that interests me and disturbs me. I really feel I've always felt that I'm just like you. I put my trousers on the same way you do. I'm a normal person. I do happen to recognize that I have done something with my life that, you know, is a little different than most people. But I feel very much an ordinary person. And I write from that perspective, too. Once I write something for me that gets past my values, then I want to play it for my wife and my friends and the band and then record it and give it to, you know, the world as a record. And I've always wanted to be able to speak my mind. And in this country, you can do that. Mm. Nobody has to agree with me at all. But at least I can speak my mind here.
So many of the classic songs you've written are still very relevant today, you know, which I don't know if that's a a comment on what a keen social observer you are or how depressing the world is. But, you know, I could point to Prison Song. You know, the United States has one of the largest populations of incarcerated people in the world. Immigration Man, you know, the population of undocumented immigrants in this country are unnecessarily harassed by ICE and local police departments. Are these songs still a part of your repertoire? And kind of how do you feel today about those messages, those songs from the past?
Unfortunately, I'm in two places. One, I'm very pleased that my music seems to have lasted this long. And secondly, what a drag that we're not learning from history. On this next tour that I'm about to start, I'm going to start by talking about Putin and Ukraine and what's going on there and sing Find the Cost of Freedom a cappella with Shane Fontaine, my guitar player, and Todd Caldwell, my keyboard player. And so I'm going to follow that with Military Madness, which I wrote for my father going off to World War II. And once again, we have failed to learn the lessons of history.
I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. My guest this week is the rock and roll legend, Graham Nash. He'll be performing at the Palladium on Sunday, April 23rd. Let's pause and listen to a pair of classic tracks from Graham Nash. From 1972, we'll hear Graham Nash and David Crosby with Immigration Man. And after that, we'll listen to Military Madness from 1971.
I got stopped by the Immigration Man. Said he doesn't know if he can. Let me in, let me in. Immigration man, can I cross the line and break? I can stay another day. Let me in, immigration man, I won't tow your line today. I can't see it anyway.
Upstairs room in Blackpool,
That was Graham Nash with Military Madness. And Graham Nash is my guest this week. He'll be performing at the Palladium on Sunday, April 23rd. Let's return to my conversation with Graham Nash as we discuss his new album, Now. And Graham, you mentioned earlier in the conversation that you are not one to kind of look back on your career. And I wanted to ask you about that. You know, the new album is titled Now. The first single released from the album is Right Now. Tell me about that title and tell me about that track. I'm going to share that track right now with our listeners.
I wanted to interest people right from the first note. I chose to open Right Now, and I chose it with my friend Todd Caldwell, who produced it with me, the entire album. But it is a very brave way to open up an album. I mean, the first line is, I used to think that I could never love again. And it's an interesting journey from that line onwards. I love Right Now. I think it's an interesting little rock and roll song.
What does that theme of now, is that like an overarching theme in your life, like focusing on the moment, focusing on the present day? Does that have any significance?
Yes, I'm focusing on my life right now. I want people to understand that at 80 years old, you can still have passion. You can still do things that you didn't do. It's an open-ended world. And I want people to know that even at 80 years old, we can still rock.
From his latest album, Now, this is Graham Nash with Right Now.
That I would never love again. I used to think that I'd be all on my own. I really thought that it was coming to an end. And just the thought of it chilled me to the bone. But not now. I always thought I really knew what I was doing, and in my mind I never thought that I would fail. But all that time was I fooling myself with the chance I took on the paths that were on my trail. Right now, here I am, still living my life. Right now, right now.
That was Graham Nash with Right Now. And Graham Nash is my guest this week. He'll be performing at the Palladium on Sunday, April 23rd. And I want to quickly remind you that we're in the middle of WFYI's Spring Pledge Drive. If you haven't donated yet, please consider doing so now at WFYI.org/give. Let's return to my conversation with Graham Nash as we discuss the importance of supporting public radio. And one last question for you, Graham. I don't know if you remember, but on your last tour, you came to our studios here at WFYI and recorded a live session. And I know you've been a very strong supporter and advocate of public media, public television, public radio. Anything you want to say about the need to support public media in the United States?
Public media, particularly here in the US of A, are incredibly important in the link between our brains and the audience. We need people like you. We need people like your station. We need people that are willing to play music that makes people think. We need it, and it's an incredibly important link between my brain and art.
Any final thoughts you want to share about this tour, the music you'll be performing, 60 years of songs and stories?
I want my audience to know two things. One, I want to be there. I'm not phoning it in. I'm not doing it half-assed. I'm going to sing every song with the same passion I had that when I wrote them. And two, my audience deserve mention. They're paying good money to come see me and do the history. I do have a couple of hundred songs to be able to choose from, which stretch all the way from the very first song that I started with the Hollies back in early 1963, all the way to the present day to a song that I'm writing this morning. And my audience understand that. They understand that we're the same I feel exactly the same as they do. And fortunately, I'm a musician and grateful to do that, to be able to share what I'm thinking. Like I said before, nobody has to agree with me at all, but at least listen to a point of view.
I can't thank you enough for taking time to talk with me today, Graham. You'll be here in Central Indiana on April 23rd at the Palladium. As I said, it was an honor to have you on the program, and I'm very appreciative of your time today.
Thank you very much, Kyle.
You can see Graham Nash live in Central Indiana at the Palladium on Sunday, April 23rd. Let's listen to one more classic song from Graham Nash from 1977. This is Crosby, Stills, and Nash with Just a Song Before I Go.
Just a song before I go, to whom it may concern. Traveling twice the speed of sound, it's easy to get burned. When the show
I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. Up next, I'll be speaking with the Pulitzer Prize-nominated composer, Augusta Reed Thomas. She'll be premiering a new work titled Toward a Secret Sky with the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir on Friday, April 28th at the Hilbert Circle Theater. Thomas is a prolific figure in the world of contemporary classical music. She's one of the most performed living composers, and her music has been championed by classical music giants, including Pierre Boulez, Lauren Mizell, and Seiji Ozawa. Before we join my conversation with Thomas, let's listen to an example of her work. From the Grammy-winning 1999 album Colors of Love, this is Chanticleer performing the Augusta Reed Thomas composition, The Rub of Love. That was Chanticleer performing the Augusta Reed Thomas composition, The Rub of Love. And Augusta Reed Thomas is my guest. Let's join our conversation.
Thank you so much for being here today. It's an honor to have you on the program. I'm a fan of your work, and it's great to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks, Kyle. I'm really honored to be on your show.
Yeah. You know, I've read a lot about your background. I know you grew up playing piano and trumpet at an early age. You also started composing at an early age. As we get started, I thought it would be helpful if you kind of explain to our listeners what your pathway to becoming a professional composer was.
Oh, thanks. What a great question. I've always loved music. I remember when I was a child, we had this rickety old piano, and I used to lie underneath it and listen to the sounds. My mom was a kindergarten teacher, and she was an amateur, and then I wanted to, like, play the piano and started making up little songs that would be like one note, like plink, And I'd be like, Mom, I wrote a song. And she'd be like, great, you know. So I was super into music and constantly followed that. As you mentioned, I played trumpet all the way through college, actually. And I played piano for 14 years. I sang in choirs. I played in brass quintet, played in church, and so on and so forth. So it's been a kind of dimensional musical background in the sense that I didn't just play one instrument and then start composing when I was 25 or something. It was really very holistic and like a gestalt of making and being in music.
I've heard you refer to yourself as a poet composer, not a novelist composer. And it seems like that's an important distinction to understand when approaching your music. Can you tell us what you mean by that, a poet composer?
Yeah, thank you. Actually, somebody else said that, but I do appreciate it. I like that because I love the way in a poem, every word is critical. You move one word to a different word, the whole poem changes. You know, you have a dash turns to a period, the meaning changes. You change the rhyme, the whole scheme changes and so forth. So it's very, very precise. You know, every dot dotted and every T crossed and this kind of thing that comes up in the works of poets are very, very interesting to me. And for instance, the work that I've done with the chorus is huge. It's 36 minutes. So someone would say, Gusty, you know, that's not a poem. It's 36 minutes long, you know, whatever. But if you actually look locally, it's highly, highly crafted, like to every last 16th note. And that's the sort of poetic side. You know, another thing that's interesting to me about poetry is that if you have, let's say, an 8-line poem, it might take you like 12 pages to describe what's going on in that poem. But the poem was able to do it in 8 lines. You know, that kind of precision of thinking.
Hmm. Yeah. It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that a turning point in your life as a composer was your association with the Chicago Symphony. From 1997 to 2006, you were a composer in residence with the Chicago Symphony. You worked with people like Pierre Boulez and Daniel Barenboim. During that time, I believe you wrote your Pulitzer Prize-nominated piece, Astral Canticle. Tell me about how this opportunity shaped your life, shaped your work. Was it kind of a turning point in your career in some ways?
Thank you for asking. I feel in some ways that every minute is a turning point in my life. Like every project, every person I meet, every opportunity, every, you know, the struggle of trying to craft the music so carefully, blah, blah, blah. It's all an opportunity. But I think you are right that it was an incredible situation in life. I loved every day there. I had this huge long residency. I wrote 9 symphonic works. I worked very hard to build the Music Now series, the Contemporary Chamber series. I hosted many, many composers. I gave probably 50 pre-concert lectures a year. I mean, it was just a huge, vast experience that I feel so grateful for and humbled by. And I had already written quite a lot of orchestral music because I was playing trumpet and I was obsessed with music since I was a little girl. So when I was offered a commission for the symphony. I'd already written like 20 orchestral pieces, which sounds ridiculous because I was so young. But I was like weird. Like I was writing symphonies all day long. Anyway, and they were mostly really bad, by the way. But in any case, Mr. Barenboim and Mr. Boulez heard one and they're like, hire her, you know, for a piece. So I wrote a piece and then it turned out they really liked the piece and they ended up recording it and touring it and so forth. And then right at the dinner that night, they were like, can you write us another piece? Which was like the best news a composer could ever get, you know? And then they asked me to be their composer in residence. So it sort of came out of the body of work I had made. It wasn't like, oh, I've never written an orchestra piece. Let me see if I can like do that. It was more of a holistic next step in the journey that I had been on.
We talked about your early life as a trumpet player, and I kind of wanted to go back to that with this next question. I know you bring a lot of influences to your music, from J.S. Bach to Luciano Berio. Jazz has also been an influence on your life and work. I know, you know, your fellow trumpet players, Louis Armstrong, Miles Davis, have been big influences. You've called Miles Davis's work with Coltrane chamber music of the highest order, which is a pretty serious compliment, right? Tell me about the influence of jazz music on your work and specifically trumpet players.
Absolutely. Well, and I completely stand by my quote. And Louis Armstrong was my idol. As a kid, I used to play along with his albums, you know, pretending I could play trumpet with him. And I used to listen to Ella, and I used to scat all the time. And but I think Louis and Ella were my childhood, the most of my idol. Like, I loved everybody, but I was obsessed with them. And I think one of the things that's interesting about jazz, well, perhaps I could say two things. One may be more historical or broad, which is that I think when we look at the history of American music, not to mention world music, but let me just, since we're talking in this way just about American music, you could argue that the great American music is jazz. And I would make that argument. Hmm. I mean, the artists from jazz are just off the charts, sublime. And so it's greatly influenced me. And I have a lot of jazz heroes. I think in my own music, the way it comes out is you can also hear that I've heard the great orchestral repertoire, that I know Ravel, that I know Stravinsky and so forth. You can also hear that I know some world music and that I know some pop and some bebop and some hip hop and so forth. So one of the things that I love about jazz is the sense of spontaneity in the making. I feel that all of my works are captured improvisations, meaning that I'm improvising. And then I'm like capturing it and codifying it so 160 singers can sing it. But it had to start in my body, in my improvisation, in a way that it would be for jazz. And I like the sense of spontaneity. You don't know quite what I'm going to do next, but then as soon as I do it, you're like, oh, that was logical. But I wouldn't have thought of it. You know, that kind of quick thinking that the jazz artists have. And the sense of enormous chamber music, as you referred to in my quote, and so forth, I think it's very, very uplifting. And so another way it materializes in my work, for instance, my composition Sundance, which was commissioned by the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, which receives its world premiere tonight, was commissioned to be in front of the Beethoven Sixth Symphony, which is the Pastoral Symphony. So I thought, well, what do you do before the Pastoral Symphony? You need a sunrise, right? You got to like get into the day. So I wrote this huge sunrise, and that's what the piece is. And then you can go straight from my piece into the Beethoven Sixth Symphony if you want to, directly, because it's the exact same instrumentation. That's the idea. But in any case, it's got a relation to jazz as well. And that has to do with groove. To a certain extent. Like, I like things where you don't exactly know what the next beat is going to be. Like, you know, maybe it's got like one e and a one e and a oom pa, cho, chica, whatever. You know, you don't quite know where the rhythm is, but it's sort of like it's in the groove, like we're grooving. But it's also, it kind of comes across as like Stravinsky a little. It's quite Stravinskian, but it's actually, I'm hearing it coming from big band. And Stravinsky. So it's kind of interesting how it might manifest itself. And rhythm would be one parameter. But I would also say, for instance, the harmonic fields that I use in all of my music are often very much like stacked chords, like da ba be ba da ba be da ba ba. It was like, wah! It's like a jazz chord. It's like a dominant 11, 14, whatever it is. But it pretty much comes straight out of the jazz tradition. But when you put it for orchestra, it ends up having a different hue or a different kind of historical background. And I think in my music, I really bridge both, but in a way that's not like, oh, there's her jazz bit, and and now she's doing the classical bit. It's not like that. It's totally integrated at the deepest level.
Thank you.
We just heard music from the composer Augusta Reed Thomas. And Thomas is my guest this week. She'll be premiering a new work titled Toward a Secret Sky with the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir on Friday, April 28th at the Hilbert Circle Theater. Go to indiechoir.org for more information. Let's return to my conversation with Augusta Reed Thomas. You've written for all sorts of instruments. I love your work for percussion. And I think you premiered a piece, Resounding Earth, here in Indiana a few years ago, right? At South Bend in Notre Dame.
We did. We did.
Tell us about your work writing for percussion.
Well, I love writing for percussion. I love writing for everything. But I love writing for orchestra. I love writing for the human voice. Love writing for chorus. And percussion has been a big part of my work. For about 35 years, I've used percussion in my orchestral works. So it's sort of everywhere in my work. But I've also done solo marimba pieces and solo vibraphone pieces and duets and trios and quartets. And I have a series of percussion quartets, one of which is called Resounding Earth, which is for 300 bells from around the world. So literally bells from every culture. And it's four movements, and the entire piece is played on metal. All of the bells are metal, and none of the movements sounds anything alike. Because the rich variety of instruments that mankind has made by pulling metal out of the earth is vast. And this piece really showcases that. And it was great fun to write. It was very technical, because every bell has its own overtones, its own tuning, different ways of notating. It took me a year to write that percussion quartet. And one of the things that's interesting is I think of it as a celebration of interrelatedness, that it's not about these humans over there and these humans over here, but all of us together. We're celebrating our interconnectedness by how we've, for literally since mankind's been around, we've been hitting metal. And I love the idea of like a gong from one corner of the world being struck against a bell from another, and then the resonance from two other traditions, whether they're functional traditions, let's say a cowbell around the neck of a cow, or perhaps a bell that's used only in sacred spaces or for meditation, and having those different kinds of functional instruments ringing together. So it's a very rich piece, and I thought they did a fantastic premiere. There's a beautiful recording of it.
I grew up in the hip-hop era, and there were two things you could do on the playground that would, like, make you an instant legend during that period of time, breakdance or beatbox. And a couple years ago, you wrote an opera, Sweet Potato Kicks the Sun, that centers a beatboxer as sort of the primary character of the opera. Tell us about this work and how you happened to stumble onto that idea.
Yeah, thank you. It was actually very true to my whole soul, because I've been scatting since I was a little girl with Ella. And when anybody asks me something, I usually like sing something, just because it's right there. I'm just hearing something in my head. I might as well just, instead of describing it, I'll just like scat something. So I'm constantly doing that. So when I had this good fortune, I'm very grateful that the Santa Fe Opera and the San Francisco Opera and five other companies approached me for an opera. The first thing that came to mind was, well, I should do a piece for beatboxer, percussion quartet, and small ensemble. And, you know, plus the chorus, the children's chorus, the other singers. Like, for instance, I wanted a light lyric. I wanted a dramatic tenor. But the beatboxer would be one of a multiplicity of voices, which is completely suiting my entire body of work. So to me, it was like normal. But, you know, sometimes presenting organizations have an idea of what would, like, you know, when you go to an opera company and you're like, I want to feature a beatboxer. And they're like, excuse me? You know? And I'm like, yeah, let's just do it. And they're like, what did you say? You know? So you have to kind of like convince people that it's true. I mean, anyone who knows my music would be like, oh, that's totally obvious. That's totally Augusta Ree Thomas all over it. So it felt very true and fun. And the beatboxer Nicole Paris is one of the most beautiful, kind, radiant, just stunning people in the planet. She's a very, very close friend of mine. In fact, she was texting me this morning, and, you know, we're in great touch. But, you know, it was very interesting for her because she doesn't read music. She'd never been to an opera. She didn't know what an opera was, which is fine. We're like, who has to know what an opera is, you know? And so the whole thing was like completely out of her. And I'm like, no, you're it. I can see it. You're going to be great. And so she was like insanely fabulous. And she also has this beautiful singing voice because I also make her sing. I mean, it's all noted. It's sort of hard to describe what the score looks like. But in any case, I remember one of the reviews said, and the best singing of operatic singing in that scene was by the beatboxer, you know, because she has this wonderful tradition of singing in her church every Sunday. So in addition to her beatbox side, she's just got this incredibly trained, natural voice. So I just saw that in her and I'm like, okay, that's it. And I really want that piece to, I really want to try to record that. It's expensive. I can't do it at the moment, but at some point before I die, that's a priority for me to see if I can hire the artists or maybe get a great college to present it. And then we capture that recording because it pains me that I have nothing to show for it because we did one show and then the pandemic hit and we canceled 7 shows. And we don't have a document because we were going to record like the 7th one. You know, why record the first one? And then we didn't never do it. So that's such a heartbreak for me.
And you're here in Indianapolis. You're going to premiere a new piece with the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir, Toward a Secret Sky, which I understand is based on the work of Rumi, 13th century Persian poet, great poet. Tell us about this work, how it came together, and, yeah, your presence here in Indianapolis.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. The poet Rumi is one of the most beloved poets in the world, in pretty much every language. I don't know how many languages it's been translated to, but, you know, probably 100. And the most beautiful, forward-looking, eloquent, poetic imagery. And he speaks a lot about love in all of his writings, in different ways. And love not just like, okay, I love you, you love me, but really like cosmic love and the depth of love and the importance of love and so on and so forth. So I just thought, you know, what a beautiful message, because I wanted to write something optimistic, but also like rich, not like dopey, like, oh, it's a happy piece or whatever, but, you know, but like rich with these beautiful themes and gorgeous words. And it brings in all kinds of love. His texts are kaleidoscopically varied. Some of them are very playful and some of them are like deeply like heart-wrenching. So it's got quite a dramatic and emotional palette. The piece is 35 minutes. I built it in 9 sections, which are structured around 9 Rumi texts that have different, for lack of a better quick word, different perfumes to them. So I wanted the music to also like set a different scene. But I build between them bridges or transitions, so it's played without a pause. On the other hand, when you get to the next section, it'll be like, oh, we're in a new section. You know, you can tell. So in that sense, it's very tightly formed in terms of the balance between the form and the material and so on and so forth. But hopefully it should just be like an immediate, accessible, kind of colorful, rich experience with this fantastic chorus. And Eric is an amazing conductor, you know, so it's going to be great. And then, of course, the ISO playing the orchestral parts. So it was a huge project. It took me many years to write it. I'm very excited. The title, Toward a Secret Sky, is, of course, wildly poetic and evocative and beautiful, especially when we're thinking about love and love, perhaps, of people that have died and we're still here or vice versa and so on and so forth. But that is the words of Rumi. and every word is of Rumi. So I'm just sort of the lucky beneficiary to set those texts.
Augusta, I know you have a very busy schedule here. Thank you so much for taking time to be here at the studio with me. It's an honor to have you on the program and a pleasure to meet you, so thank you.
I'm so honored to be here. Thank you.
My guest this week has been the composer, Augusta Reed Thomas. She'll be premiering a new work titled Toward a Secret Sky with the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir on Friday, April 28th at the Hilbert Circle Theater. We'll end this week's show with the recording of Thomas's Pulitzer Prize-nominated composition, Astral Canticles. And before we go, I want to remind you, there's still time to support WFYI's Spring Pledge Drive. Go to wfyi.org/give for more information. Thank you to my guests, Graham Nash and Augusta Reed Thomas. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Kyle Long, and you've been listening to Cultural Manifesto. Thank you.